This is Community Transformed with Father Thomas Dubay.
Thank you for joining us once again this week. I'm Father Thomas Dubay, and you will remember last week we were dealing with what I called sharpening our concepts. We're talking about gospel community, which is much more than what we humans would expect when we think about community. And we were dealing with shared vision, one mind, as St. Luke calls it in his gospel and the Acts of the Apostles. And among the concepts that we were sharpening up, one of them was vision. By vision here, we mean with our mind, we see truth. A shared vision is a sharing of truth with somebody else, and truth being a contact with reality, being in touch. In shared vision, we are more deeply in touch with reality with another person, whether that happens to be a husband and wife, or members of a religious order, or in a city, state, a government. We like to have some kind of vision together, but you really don't require it because it's humanly impossible. Then we spoke about levels of shared vision, and we're talking in this series mainly about, almost exclusively, about deep principles and the profound bedrocks of reality, that we must have a shared vision about that if we're going to have close and intimate community, especially in vocation communities like marriage, religious life, priesthood, and so on. We spoke about two levels, the deep ones where we need the vision, the practicalities, nice if we have vision together, but it's not absolutely crucial. Then we said a few words about what this vision is not. It's not imposed. It's not a rigid thing. It's freely embraced, given by the Holy Spirit when the two people or the members of a larger community are in step with the Holy Spirit and receive His light. Then they have a vision together, and nobody has imposed it. Now, we come this week to one more concept to be clarified, and it's a deeply important one, too. It's a question of diversity. Of course, there's diversity among peoples, and even gospel communities have a healthy kind of diversity, pluralism, we also call it, and then there's an unhealthy diversity, pluralism. And I want to make that distinction so that we're clear when we speak about diversity of what we're talking about. The real and the healthy thing is good. We call it complementary diversity. Now notice, take a marriage, for example. Husband and wife are two different people, two different families, very likely a quite different upbringing, at least in many ways. They've gone to different schools, they've listened to different teachers, they've read different books, they've had different friends. They have their own personal characteristics, competent in one field and not so competent in another, liking this sort of thing and not liking something else. And so there's a great deal of diversity. Now, there's a lot of health about this, because in a community where the members are so diverse in many ways, I haven't even mentioned other ways, talents, we are very different in talents. In a healthy community, this kind of difference, pluralism if you want, is a healthy thing. Same thing goes for, say, a religious order, a group of nuns, suppose, living together. They also come from different families, different backgrounds, different training, different talents, different gifts, different preferences, and all the rest. Now, what is good about this complementary diversity is, as the word indicates, each one helps to complement the other ones. We're all diverse, and not only diverse, but we're differently talented. And so I can do certain things, and you probably can't do those, but you can do other things that I cannot do. So that, take marriage again. Husband and wife, with their complementary, different, but filling in each other, their different gifts and talents and backgrounds and preferences, they complete each other. Now this is very good indeed. It's needed, as a matter of fact. So nobody is trying to impose something else when we talk about one mind and shared vision. Now, the other kind of difference is bad news. We call it contradictory diversity. Now, and I borrow here logic. I want to borrow the concept from logic that in a contradiction, which means One person says yes, and another person says no, to the same idea, with the same meaning, and the same meaning at the same time. Now, in a contradiction, one of the two is right, and the other one has got to be wrong. There's no middle ground. They don't complement and fulfill and complete each other, because one is, and the other is not. And to affirm what is not is, of course, very bad news. Let me use a couple examples. Suppose you have two people in a religious order who disagree about the vow of poverty. And I just used a little bit about what that means, and you can see how damaging this kind of contradiction, this diversity really is. Suppose one holds that religious vow of poverty means that you must be poor in fact, not destitute, but poor in fact, and you do not own anything that you use. For example, I have such a vow. This watch on my wrist is not mine. The jacket is not mine. I don't own anything. Now, suppose that's the way it really is. That's what it means. Now, suppose somebody else in our order or a group of people say, no, poverty doesn't mean that. It means that you are respectful of creation and you do own things and you may dispose of them as you like and so on. Now, in a contradiction where one says it means this and the other denies exactly that, one of them has to be out of touch with reality. And that is bad news, because the person is not in touch with what his life means. And he's not going to live it, and it's not going to work, by definition. And the same sort of thing happens in marriage. If the husband says that marriage is thus and so, and the wife says, no, it is not thus and so, meaning the same thing, then one of the two has got to be out of touch with marriage. And obviously, the marriage is going to flounder, if not absolutely fail, because they are not of one mind about what they're doing in the vocation. So this sharpening of concept is very important. And I suppose that people who would disagree with the idea of shared vision don't have this sharply in their minds. I'm pretty sure they don't. Probably a few other things. I'd like to use an example here to show you how basically important one mind is about fundamental things. And I like to use the example of traveling, of which, of course, as you may know, I do a lot. Suppose you're going to travel from Los Angeles to Honolulu. And suppose when you're about ready for boarding, the airline comes on the public address system and says something like this: ladies and gentlemen, our jet 747 jet flight for Honolulu is just about ready to go, but we're a very honest airline, and we want to tell you that there's a disagreement about the fuel tanks. The cockpit crew says that the tanks are full. We'll get to Honolulu fine. The ground crew says they are not full. They're hardly half full. So there's a contradiction between the two. That is, one says they are full, the other says in the same sense they're not full. Now, it matters a great deal who is right. So that if somebody says, well, you have your opinion of it, and that's true for you, and you have your opinion of it, and that's true for you, so we're not going to worry about it. We're going to board the plane now, even though there's that kind of disagreement between our personnel. Well, you can be sure nobody is going to board the plane, because one of the two is out of touch with reality. And if it happens to be the wrong one, then you are in trouble. Namely, if the tanks are half full, as the ground crew says, well, then too bad if you're going to follow the cockpit crew. And so that is true in vocations and states in life and in community. If there's that kind of difference between husband and wife or two factions in a religious community, well, they're headed for big trouble. And that's one of the reasons these contemporaries I cited a couple weeks ago say there's so many fights in marriage. On average, once a month, one study said, couples fight about something. Now, if it's based on this kind of problem, they don't have a shared vision about marriage in important things, that's what we're talking about, important things, basic things, well, then their marriage is headed for the rocks, very likely. Okay, so I think we have finished up with that particular concept and clarification. Now, our next main item in dealing with shared vision taking another step. And that step is that human beings, you and I, need union to make it as human beings. I cannot become a full human being without other people. And that, of course, is just obviously true of the baby. The baby will die shortly without mother and father or somebody to take care of the baby. But even as we grow older and become adults, we need other people, dramatically need them, or we're going to shrivel up and become a prune. Prunes, the fruit, are good things. Human prunes are bad things. And we human beings are made, therefore, for union. God made us social beings. We're unique persons, yes, and we go to Him as unique persons. I'm not going to give an account in Judgment Day for you, how you chose to act and not act. I'm going to give an account for me, though, and that's true of every one of us. So that God made us to be in union with others, and most of all, in union with Himself. We've spoken about that in another series at length, the call to a deep contemplative prayer life. That was one of the whole aspects of the reality. We don't make it without a deep union with God. But we also need types of union among us human beings. And that's a point I want to make right at this moment. We're incomplete by our very nature, which is, of course, why God made us, and in Genesis points this out, that Adam alone was not enough. Adam needed a complementary. He needed the woman, or he wouldn't make it as a human being. And so God made us of two sexes for that reason. We're social beings. Now, this is why, one reason why, truth is so immensely important. Because it puts us in contact with the rest of reality. On that flight to Beijing, supposing you did get off and suppose there was a fuel tank full of fuel, well, your union with the truth, namely the amount of fuel in the tank, being in touch with reality gets you to Beijing. Or, I know they were going to Honolulu, weren't they? Doesn't matter, you know the example. So that truth is a conformity of a mind with reality. That's what I call here being in touch with reality. And truth, therefore, notice, is a union of a mind with the thing known or the person known. So for you to know another individual, a friend, for example, is to be in union with that friend, whereas if you never met a person, that kind of union is just missing, obviously. Now, in my outline here, I have in front of me a couple sentences that I want to go over with you almost word by word, because the content is so important. And not only for our theme, gospel community, and to understand deeply what a calm unity is. Notice, by the way, the word community means calm, which is with oneness, a oneness with somebody and somebody's other people. And here is the little paragraph I want to share with you with commentary. The more alive, vibrant, and innerly rich a person is, notice I'm not talking about any person, I'm talking about one that is alive, vibrant, and innerly rich, the more that person yearns for deep interpersonal union. Not simply a bodily union. Let's look at that deeply. This is not well understood in our society. The more alive you are as an individual, the more vibrant, the livingness, zippiness, if you want, and innerly rich you are as a person, the more you want and yearn for a deep interpersonal relationship with another. Not simply bodily union, but more profoundly a mind and heart, an intellect and a will union. If there are people, and I'm afraid there are, who are looking only for bodily union, they are shallow, they're very poor inside, probably deeply wounded. And I don't intend here to throw bricks at anybody else, but it's just a fact of life. And the more the person is healthy inside and living and well, zippy will do the trick, the more that person wants a mind, heart, soul, intellect, will union with another. And that is true in any vocation. It's true, of course, obviously, in marriage. It's true in religious life, where the bodily union is not there, but the other aspects of union, which are the deepest aspects, they must be there in any kind of community that would qualify for what we're talking about in our series. The second sentence in this paragraph I should like to dwell on with a bit of detail is this, that the most beautiful men and women, the saints, are so splendidly, that is beautiful, precisely because they are so intimately united, mind, heart, soul, with the supreme goodness and beauty, the Blessed Trinity, which is why they're so beautiful. Because they drink, and in this kind of union, one begins to share the beauty of the other. You can already see, whether it's religious life in a monastery, or whether it's married couple, you can see the beauty of the gospel concept of marriage. And this is only one aspect of it, though it's at the core of the reality. And it's part of the shared vision idea that we have been talking about now for a couple weeks. That participation, say with the supreme beauty, God Himself, of course, brings all kinds of most happy results with it. We talked about them when we dealt with that other theme, gospel contemplation, the call to a deep contemplative prayer life. Now, all of that prepares us for what comes next. So we just finished the point to recap it, make it clear. The human person is made for union. And without union, there is no full completion. And it's got to mostly include mind, heart, intellect, and will. And that's what our subject is right now, shared vision. That's another way of saying that profound union. Now, our next task, as we develop the theme through all the 13 segments of this series, our next task is to take a look at the New Testament about shared vision. We've explained what it is not, and the concepts have been sharpened up, and so we're all ready now to appreciate more deeply what the New Testament says about shared vision. There are two texts that we already used a couple weeks ago, and I think it was last week also, and I'll just refer to them, and then we'll take a few more texts that we have not looked at all, to see this one point I want to make first. There are two points, and first one is shared vision in marriage, in religious life, in priesthood, is not optional. Great if you have it, and don't worry if you don't. If you don't have it, you are in trouble in your state in life. And I want to show you that from the New Testament. Let's just recall rapidly John 17, 23, Jesus praying, Last Supper, to the Father, Father, may they be completely one. And of course, completely one must include mind, heart, intellect, and will. Or it's not complete. It's not even that which sets us aside from mere animals. So you have to have that. And the Lord is referring to that particular fact. But there's some additional things he's referring to that we won't go into at the moment. And then there is 1 Corinthians 1:10, where Paul pleads with the Corinthians at the very beginning of the letter, as we noticed this already. I won't read the whole text and dwell on it with you, but we'll at least recall what we said. After introduction to the letter, he then addresses the problem in Corinth. This is about the year 50 or 51 this letter was written, and the community was already a divided community. And Paul couldn't stand that they are divided, so contrary to the Lord's will, and also contrary to what we've been saying now in this program today. Says Paul, all the same, I do appeal to you, brothers and sisters. Please notice, he's not trying to impose it on anybody. He's appealing to them. I'm not trying to impose anything on anybody, of course not. The Holy Father himself has said to the faithful and to the world, he said the church, Catholic Church, does not impose, it proposes. That says it nicely. Anyhow, Paul is very bothered about their disunity in Corinth. I appeal to you, brothers, for the sake of our Lord Jesus Christ, to make up the differences between you, and instead of disagreeing among yourselves, to be united again in your belief and practice. And as we noted, I think the original Greek, if I remember, makes it even stronger. I appeal to you to be a perfect unity of mind. As we have been explaining it, that's what Paul means. Now, the text I want to look at, in addition, notice none of this is optional. It's got to be if you want a real gospel community. If you want a real marriage according to the mind of God, which is the only kind of marriage that can be a happy one, fully happy. Let's take a look at Philippians. We haven't looked at this text at all so far. At Philippians chapter 2, Paul has this to say to them. And I'd ask you to notice how deeply emotional he is. Emotional in a good sense of the term, because emotions are not bad. If we go only by our emotions and our feelings, we might be headed for problems. But there's a good kind of emotion, and Paul feels this thing deeply, our subject. Listen to him in verses 1 and 2. If our life in Christ means anything to you, if love can persuade at all, notice persuade, he's not forcing anything, or the spirit that we have in common, or any tenderness and sympathy, then be united in your convictions and united in your love with a common purpose and a common mind. That is a shared vision. It is so important, says Paul, I'm pleading with you. If anything will touch you at all in our community, and notice this goes for the whole community. It goes for parishes, and it goes for dioceses, and it certainly goes for marriage and religious life and any other primary group, and as much as possible, even in the wider sense, say, of a nursing home, that the members of that community should have as much as possible that oneness of mind that Paul pleads for. Then he adds, that is the one thing which would make me completely happy. Now, the fourth text I want to mention here is from the other point of view. Paul has been speaking, the Lord has been speaking about the positive need for this. Now, we've got a text, the Lord speaking, Matthew 12:25. And this is from the results of lacking a unity such as we're talking about, namely the shared vision. And this is the Lord talking. I quote Matthew 12:25. This time I'm using New American Bible. Usually I use Jerusalem Bible, but this time it is the American. Okay. Here is what he says. A town or household split into factions cannot last for long. That is exactly what we're seeing in human life. Notice the sentence, it's so clear. A town or a household, that's a marriage and a family, primary community. It's a household is also a religious order or a convent or a monastery. A town or household split into factions, contradictory diversity, as we have clarified the terminology, split into factions, cannot last for long. It's doomed. And that's exactly what a divorce is. It's a destruction of what God has made holy, is holy, supposed to be a union of mind and body, you see, and it's sundered. Exactly what he said would happen. A religious community that's polarized, and they don't get over the polarization. A town or household split into factions cannot last for long. Let me give you another example. Acts of the Apostles, chapter 2, verse 42. There is a description here. It's probably the most ecclesial text in the New Testament. There's discussion here of the early community, ideal community, in the first century. The summary is this, in these words. These, the faithful, remained faithful to the teaching of the apostles. Notice, number one, teaching, to the brotherhood, their community life, to the breaking of bread, that's the Eucharist, that's what they called the Eucharist in those days, and to the prayers, their prayer life. That summarizes very much exactly what the church is about. Notice the first thing, they are one in the teaching of the apostles. They've got a shared vision about revealed truth. That's put in the first spot, notice. And then they are of one mind about community life and the Eucharist, which is the most important thing in the divine revelation, and to their prayer life, which is all bound up with the Eucharist and community. And that is the kind of way we're supposed to be living in any kind of community. The beautiful example. We'll take up at this point next week and go a little bit further in gospel community, and especially the shared vision aspect of it, and we're going to analyze, why does the New Testament say these things? Thank you. See you next week.
You have been listening to Community Transformed with Father Thomas Dubé on EWTN Global Catholic Radio.